On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
There's also a rumor that in the 40s and 50s, Norman Chandler, who was Harry Chandler's son and publisher of the Times at the time, hid a secret second family in that house. I haven't seen any proof of it. That's the rumor that may be also part of why it's thought to be a Chandler-built house.
What's the real story behind that big, spooky house sitting empty in the middle of Southern California's biggest oil field? We'll unravel the mystery later in the show. But first, the head of one of the world's deadliest drug cartels sits in a Mexican prison. The government trumpets his capture as a major blow to the drug trade in the country. Pats on the back are delivered, TikToks of the spectacular capture run in newspapers and on TV. And then one day, the king of the narcos simply walks out of prison and back into the drug trade. Yeah, we're talking about Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, but this is also how novelist Don Winslow's latest crime epic begins, with the fictional government-sanctioned prison break of a cartel kingpin. The new book is called The Cartel, and Don Winslow is here now in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, crazy timing. Your book comes out just as El Chapo really escapes.
Crazy timing.
Did you plan this?
No, I did not. We've been accused of it a lot.
You have?
Yeah, absolutely. But no, I didn't do it. And, you know, in all candor, I'd wish he's back in a cell. This is a really bad guy.
Yeah, he's a really bad guy, really brutal, and head of the Sinaloa cartel. And your character is modeled after him?
In some ways, yeah. Listen, my character's actions are modeled after him. This is a continuation, this book, of a book I did about 10 years ago called The Power of the Dog. And so this character goes across about 45 years. So if you're following the Mexican drug situation in this period of time, 2001 to the present, you really want to be following the Sinaloa cartel, and that means Chapo Guzman. So his actions, yes. His personality, not so much.
How did he become the guy? How did he, Chapo, become the main drug lord? Because it wasn't that long ago that you know, he was not the leader.
He was not. In fact, during his first day in prison, and this is his second prison escape, you know, he wasn't that big a deal. But he's been at the center of the drug trade since he was 15 years old. He was 17. He was the apprentice to the Lord of the Skies. He was a little older. He was the right-hand man and driver of a guy named Gallardo, who was, El Padrino, the godfather. And so he studied at the feet of these people and became very essential to the cocaine connection with Colombia. When he comes out in 2001, bought his way out, he started to reassemble Gallardo's federation and tried to conquer basically all the other cartels to put them into one unit under his leadership. That touched off violence that took, 100,000 lives or more.
This is exactly the plot of your book.
As a matter of fact, it is. Yeah.
And you talk about the rise of the Zetas.
Yeah.
And recently, a few months ago, I think in March, the head of the Zetas in real life was caught.
Right.
And so they are considered extremely brutal, this drug organization, this cartel. What's happening with them?
Well, they're on the decline because the Sinaloa cartel, who have been, at various times their allies or blood enemies, depending on, what day it is, have basically won that war. And so the Zetas are on the decline. Sinaloa is dominant now. And stay tuned. We'll see what happens.
Now even more dominant now that El Chapo is out?
I don't think it made a bit of difference that Chapo was in for 17 months. He could run his organization from the inside. We just found out that he had access to cell phones and, GPS and all of that kind of thing. So I'm sure that he was still running his organization in partnership with a guy named Mayo Zambada while he was in prison. So it's easier for him to run it when he's out. But listen, he was running it when he was in.
There has been a lot of speculation about how he escaped. And, you know, we saw these pictures that the Mexican government showed the world of the tunnel and the escape route with, you're kind of smiling, like, maybe that was just for show?
Listen, I don't know for sure. If I had to bet today, I would say it's just for show. When he escaped in 2001, for instance, the story was put out that he escaped in a laundry cart. Well, Chapo Guzman never went out of that prison in a laundry cart. He went out in a car, maybe even a helicopter from the roof. So it would not surprise me at all. And if you look at that footage, it's about as convincing as a Bigfoot video, by the way. Here's a man who gets into the shower, fully clothed, comes out, puts his shoes on, goes back into the shower. You never see him get into the tunnel, by the way. And so I think it was a face-saving device, yeah. But I could be wrong.
That the prison authorities actually created that tunnel to make it look like he did it, and they just let him walk out of the prison?
Yeah. Well, if the past is prologue.
And why would they do that, though?
Well, listen, he's Chapo Guzman. He is a multi-billionaire. He has the power to make you comfortable for the rest of your life, or on the other hand, kill you and your entire family. On the governmental side, he can make those people even richer than they are. There's some school of thought that the government's happier with Chapo on the outside than they are with him on the inside, because they've cut a deal that goes back years with the Sinaloa cartel, that they be the winners of this war because they are the least worst option as opposed
to
the
Zetas. So it's actually in the interest of public safety that they should let him out to calm down everything that's happening?
Well, that's one view. What you don't want, what the Mexican government does not want, is for that drug war to break out in its full violence again. And with Chapo in prison, that could happen. And so I'm sure that Chapo made that point to the authorities as well. But you're probably looking at money, and you're looking at intimidation. I have to laugh when journalists, you know, stand up in front of cameras and seriously ask the question, do you think that Chapo had help from the outside? Well, a tunnel came in a mile from the outside, didn't it, Madeline? So, you know, he's not sitting down there with a spoon. This is not Harry Houdini. This is not the Shawshank Redemption. This is a man with billions of dollars who also knows where all the bodies are buried. You know, so his two choices are stay in a Mexican prison and potentially escape, or get extradited to the United States. Once he's there, he has only one deal to make, and that's to rat out people very high up in Mexican police and government. Nobody wanted that except the Americans.
So I have heard that this has set back U.S.-Mexico relations 10 years. And people can't trust President Enrique Peña Nieto any longer. He had made a big show that this is it, that he's going to crack down on the cartels, arrested Chapo. And now some people on this side of the border are saying this is ridiculous.
Well, it is. But listen, you know, if you're talking about corruption, I think you have to talk about the United States as well. It's easy to point a finger at Mexico and say they're corrupt. And of course they are. This is an obvious example of it. However, we're the largest drug market in the world. We make up, you know, we use 25% of the world's illicit drugs. We're 5% of the world's population. That's corruption of its own.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Don Winslow. He's written a new novel. It's called The Cartel. And your book seems like it could be actually a work of nonfiction. You've done many years of research. And how did you get all this information? Did you do... you did reporting in Mexico and here? Did you rely on other journalists' accounts, a combination of both?
Yeah, all of the above. You know, I'm not a journalist, I'm a novelist. This is a thriller, you know, and ultimately my job is to entertain and intrigue and be a little frightening, but also to inform. So, yeah, I use all kinds of methods. I read journalism, I talk to journalists, I also talk to DEA people, drug traffickers, citizens. Name it, addicts, convicts.
I wonder, though, if it's safer for you to write a book of fiction than actually, you know, publish something in a newspaper about this. Because, you know, you can always say, oh, well, I didn't really mean you, Mr. drug cartel leader.
Yeah. Well, no doubt. I mean, I think I'm afforded a level of protection on two ways. You know, one is it is fiction. And I'm a novelist. And the other is, let's face it, I'm an American. And we have a level of protection that Mexican people don't. Having said that, I've published probably a dozen newspaper articles and commentaries about this I think just this morning I called Chapo Guzman a murdering dirtbag, so there you are.
Is this an obsession for you?
I'd like to say it wasn't, but it would be rude to take up your time and lie to you or lie to your listeners.
I guess the question, the better question is, why is this an obsession for you? Why the two books and the endless op-eds and speaking engagements about this issue? What, you're a novelist, you could pick many subjects.
Yeah, the next one's going to be different. You know, I started this back in 1998, after the slaughter of 19 people in Mexico, and I, at the time, thought that was the worst thing that could happen. I was very wrong. I think, you know, even a novelist, even a crime novelist, even a thriller writer, you see these things and you want to know why. You want to try to, in a fictional way, answer the question, how could these things happen? How could people, human beings, get to the point where they're capable of this sort of thing? I think I know the answers, and I wanted to communicate those. I want my readers to understand, you know, what's happened in Mexico over these years. Now, I do write thrillers. I do write entertainments. And yet, I guess you feel a responsibility, or I feel a responsibility to not just be a voyeur, you know, spend too much time looking at atrocity videos and photos. Always tried, at least, even if I don't use it in the book, to give those people names. You know, find out what their real stories are, because they all have hopes and dreams and fears and loves and families and all the things that humans have. In researching the book, you know, I go to the funerals and talk to the families and see people who are in prison for 20 years.
So you actually get to know them.
Yeah.
And you feel a personal connection to them.
Sure. So, obsessed? I don't know. I don't know that I'm obsessed. I'm not a crusader and not a hero. But, yeah, if I get a chance to say some things about this or maybe make people aware of this issue, I'll do that. Yeah.
Do you ever worry that you're painting too bloody a picture of Mexico, that there's a lot that's going on in Mexico that doesn't involve the drug war?
No, absolutely. And I try to write about that in this book. You know, I was very careful and enthused, you know, to have scenes in there that had nothing to do with the drug war, and to talk about the artists and the writers and the food and the warmth and, you know, the good things about Mexico. I live on the border. You know, I live in a very bicultural area. And so these people are my neighbors, you know. I eat a lot more tortillas than I eat bread. You know, my son, when he was growing up, if he wanted to swear, he swore in Spanish. So, I really hope that I've brought that across. So I do want people to see that.
Given the fact that it's hard to get accurate information out of Mexico for various reasons on what's happening with the drug war, and we here on this side of the border, we get spotty information as well, do you think it's I don't want to say more accurate, but do you think you get to a better truth by reading a work of fiction as a reader about what's happening there?
Yeah, you ask a really interesting, complex question. You know, one of the reasons we can't get accurate information is because the cartels decided that they needed to control the narrative. They're that sophisticated. They know in this age you can't just control the action. You need to tell the story. And so they did a lot to shut coverage of what they do down in order to, you know, to give their version of events. So that's one part of the answer. But I think that fiction can do things that journalism can't or shouldn't, you know, in that we're allowed, we novelists are allowed to imagine the inner lives of our characters, to give them dialogue, to give them thoughts, to give them feelings without necessarily getting a direct quote that journalists need. This great journalism out there about this, you know, fantastic journalism. But I think that novels, yeah, in some way can bring a reader closer to the reality in an odd kind of way, but certainly make them feel it, because I hope that people get invested in these characters and care about them, and then when things happen, it means something.
Well, Don Winslow, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's Don Winslow. His new novel is called The Cartel. Just ahead, there are a few oil fields in Los Angeles, but only one that has a 100-year-old house in the middle of it. The Baldwin Hills Mystery Home. That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There's a century-old house hidden in the middle of an oil field in Baldwin Hills. Few people know it's there. Even fewer know its history. Today, we unpack the mystery. Press Play producer Anna Scott has the story.
Kenneth Hahn State Park in Baldwin Hills might be one of the most unusual places in L.A. It's a gorgeous green park full of trees and hiking trails. But when you look out at the view from those trails, you see acres of industrial-looking oil rigs. The park is right next to the huge Inglewood oil field. It looks like a slice of Bakersfield or West Texas plopped right in the middle of L.A. And if that isn't surprising enough, there's something else. If you stand in the park and you look at the oil field from the right angle, you'll see that there's a house on it. Yes, a house on the oil field right near some wells. And not a little shack, but a hulking brick house with white trim and a green pointed roof. So, who on earth would build a house in the middle of a huge oil field? I went to the park and asked some hikers there if they knew anything about it.
Yeah, it's to the right.
What do you think that is?
I have no idea, but it looks like a big house. It looks like an old house.
I've never noticed it. It looks kind of weird.
I don't know, but my sister was telling me a story about some house that's in the middle of the oil fields. I could call my sister up and she could tell you.
This lady from KCRW is here. She's asking questions.
He called his sister, but she didn't know much. She said the house is really old, maybe from the 1800s. If that's true, then it was built way before the oil field came to be. The sister also said that the house now gets used as a location for film and TV shoots. And indeed, it turns out the house has a website for location scouts, baldwinhillsoilhouse.com. The site says the home was built in 1896, but nothing else about its history. The contact person listed, Liz Gosnell, told me the owners do not do press, and the house is behind oil field security gates, so you can't just walk up to it. Somebody has to know something about this huge house in the middle of an oil field in the middle of L.A.
We were looking for the scary house on the hill.
Vincent Jeffords is a production designer for the TV show Criminal Minds. He was looking for a scary house on a hill, and he got one. A rambling 5,000-square-foot home with a patio, with dark wooden beams along the ceilings and multiple fireplaces.
It's a really strangely situated house. It's an old brick, four-bedroom, kind of a small mansion. And it just sits in this barren industrial landscape of these pumps just pumping away and these old shaggy eucalyptus trees. The story that I heard was that an East Coast judge had moved out. He was married, but he had a mistress, and he built the house and it was going to install his mistress in this house. But they also heard that there were hidey holes in the old fireplace. There were places to hide stuff. Yeah, places to hide things. That may have been to hide booze. I don't know. Anyway, it's an odd house. It has a very weird house and a very weird vibe. A spooky old house.
I can remember some nights there were, like, you know, strange creakings and, you know, like footsteps on the second floor.
Eric Parley lived at the house. He subleased a room there for a few years in the early 80s.
You know, at night you just sort of hear the lull in the distance of all of these electric pumps pumping the wells. and it was actually kind of, you know, we literally could lull you to sleep. You just had, you know, almost like miles and miles of roads that you could drive on, and once you got in behind the gates, it was like being inside this crazy estate with beautiful views. I mean, you could see the Hollywood sign, you could see, you know, out towards the ocean and everything. It was pretty amazing.
Did you hear, you know, rumors or snippets about the house's history? Or
I had gotten some of the stories. I vaguely remember that somebody had committed suicide there, and maybe the scene of that was actually in the basement. I don't know. But I always had heard that it was Harrison Gray Otis that built the house for his buddies.
Yes. He just said Harrison Gray Otis, publisher of the LA Times in the late 18 and early 1900s, patriarch of the Chandler family, LA royalty. So now I've talked to someone who's lived at the house. I've talked to someone who's worked there. I've heard these intriguing rumors, but I still don't really know anything about this huge house in the middle of a huge oil field. The house doesn't have an address, so it's hard to track down any property records. The LA Conservancy, a preservation organization, has never heard of it. So many dead ends. Until I found someone who seemed to know something. This person had been posting all kinds of details about the house on a website I stumbled on after many Google searches called the Skyscraper Forum.
My name is Mike Davison. I grew up in the area and remember being in the car driving through La Cienega, through the Baldwin Hills, and seeing that house in the middle of the oil field and always wondering why it was there.
Mike Davison isn't a historian. He's not a professor. He's a 53-year-old guy who's worked as a writer and in banking, and history's his hobby. For the past few years, he's extensively researched the house on the oil field. He's combed through map books that the county keeps in a basement downtown. He's pieced together nearly century-old newspaper articles and writings by obscure local historians.
The man who built the house was named Charles Wellington Rand, approximately from August 1914 through January 1915 is when the house was built.
At that time, the house would have sat high above miles and miles of rolling hills. No oil drilling yet, no real estate development, just a quiet country landscape.
And who is this Charles Rand? What did he do?
He was a lumber baron from Iowa. How you get to be a lumber baron in Iowa, I'm not sure. His father died when he was 12. His mother moved himself and his older brother and younger sister out to Los Angeles to live with her father. His name was Hiram Higgins. He lived about two blocks west on Wilshire Boulevard from where General Harrison Gray Otis lived, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times. And apparently just through being neighbors, the two families got to be very close.
Is that why there's this rumor out there that that house on the oil field was owned by a Chandler family person?
That may be part of it. Harrison Gray Otis's son-in-law was Harry Chandler. Harry Chandler's nephew was Ralph Chandler. Ralph Chandler and Charles Wellington Rand became friends. They also, Rand and Ralph Chandler, were partners in an automobile business on Flower Street. After Rand passed away, Ralph Chandler may have used the house. There's also a rumor that in the 40s and 50s, Norman Chandler, who was Harry Chandler's son and publisher of the Times at the time, hid a secret second family in that house. I haven't seen any proof of it. That's the rumor that may be also part of why it's thought to be a Chandler-built house. But Rand definitely is the man who built the house.
Aha. So all these rumors of a Chandler family connection, of a mistress, it's all coming together. But who were these people, really?
A lot of society column issues about Mrs. Rand, her travels. She liked to travel around the world, go to Europe for months at a time. I'm not sure I would have liked her. She doesn't seem like a very likable person. She left her young children alone a lot to go travel after their father died and doesn't seem to have been a very good mother, if you ask me.
So what happened to Rand?
As I said, I don't think he had a particularly easy life. He eloped in 1911 with a young woman who, 3 weeks after their elopement, admitted she had not gotten a divorce from the person she was actually married to. So, and that relationship apparently ran hot and cold until 1917. He finally got an annulment in early 1917. So his personal life seems to have been somewhat unsettled.
His life was unsettled, and it didn't end well.
In October 1917, October 3rd to be exact, he changed his will to leave everything he had to his mother and his sister, presumably from his now ex-wife. And on October 5th, 1917, he shot himself in the head with a shotgun and killed himself in the house in the Baldwin Hills.
After Rand died, his family sold the house to a woman named Emma Cohn and her husband Irving in 1923. Their relatives still own the house today. The Cohns, it turned out, had very good timing. They signed the first oil lease in Baldwin Hills in 1924, and now the house sits in the center of the biggest urban oil field in the country. Still a spooky old house on a hill, but also a very valuable one. For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
Hit songs by Britney Spears, Taylor Swift, Kelly Clarkson, they all come from the same place, Sweden. We'll talk to the author of a new book on the Swedish hit factory.
Oh my gosh, I'm like a guy in his 50s and I'm sitting here spending the whole day writing about Katy Perry.
How hits are made after this news update.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Lennon and McCartney. The two Beatles need no introduction. They've written the most number one hit songs of all time. In third place, a 44-year-old Swedish producer named Max Martin. He's written songs for the biggest pop stars of the past 20 years, from Britney Spears to Taylor Swift. And he helped pioneer the songwriting approach that today's top hitmakers use. We'll hear from one of those hitmakers later in this segment. But first, John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and his new book is called The Song Machine, Inside the Hit Factory. When we spoke earlier, I asked him why he started his story where he did, in Sweden, in the late 1980s.
Sweden, which has become such a huge force in popular music, was just at that point beginning its rise. So really I began there because there was a fellow named Dennis Popp who gathered around him a group of Swedish producers and songwriters, the most prominent of whom came to be known as Max Martin.
Dennis Popp and Max Martin got their big break when an unknown Swedish band sent them a demo tape. They described what happened in an interview in 1995.
Well, my name is Dennis Popp. This here is Max Martin. And I got a cassette sent to my house saying, please listen to our demos and call us Azer Bass.
Azer Bass was a Swedish kind of techno-y group that was from Gothenburg, which is seen as sort of an industrial outlier in Swedish culture.
I took the tape and I put it in my car stereo and it got stuck. So I kept hearing it. Every time I drove in that car, I kept hearing the same song. It was called Mr. Ace.
He had nothing else to listen to except for this song. And he ended up listening to it for a week till he got his cassette player fixed. And somewhere in the course of the week, he went from absolutely hating the song to realizing that he was actually going to do this song and that this could be a hit song. And in fact, it did become a huge hit song, which is the song All That She Wants. You know, all that she wants is another baby. She's gone tomorrow.
Well, also, I mean, this is interesting that not only did he create his own earworm, but he also kind of codified this idea that you should really listen to these songs in the car. And this is a big deal now for Swedish producers, and they actually have a name for it, the LA car test.
Yeah, listening to songs in the car and making songs that sound good in the car is a very important part of making top 40 hits. And actually, in Sweden, they came to feel that you can't just drive it around Stockholm. You have to drive it up and down the Pacific Coast Highway because that's where you're really going to tell. And I
really?
Guess that still happens.
They would send their songs from Sweden to someone to drive up and
they
down.
They still do it. I mean, they do it all the time.
Their work for Ace of Base put Dennis Popp and Max Martin on the map. But it was their string of hits for the Backstreet Boys and Britney Spears that crowned them pop royalty in the late 90s. As you mentioned, Max Martin, he was Dennis Popp's protege, and the two worked together.
Yeah. Dennis Popp got sick at a very young age, and Max Martin, who probably would have continued working under Dennis, was forced to sort of step out on his own in 1998 when Dennis Popp died at the age of 35. And that was the year that Britney Spears came out with Max's first number one, first of 22, which was Hit Me Baby One More Time. And that started this just amazing, kind of historically unprecedented run of hits that is going stronger than ever right now. I mean, you know, The Weeknd is Can't Feel My Face is his latest number one. It's on the charts.
I can't feel my face when I'm with you, but I love it.
All those Taylor Swift songs are his songs.
He writes all the Taylor Swift songs?
He wrote the songs from 1989. So Bad Blood and Shake It Off and Style. I mean, Taylor wrote them with him. But this is, Taylor Swift, who started out as kind of a singer-songwriter type, really obviously made a very clear decision in joining forces with him that she was going to become, you know, a pop star in the tradition of Britney Spears and Kelly Clarkson and Katy Perry, all of whom Max has written songs for in the past. And so they joined forces, and now she's going around playing stadiums.
John Seabrook says that Max Martin is successful because of his distinct Swedish songwriting style. Yeah, and I think I found really interesting in your book is you say that they thought the chorus was important rather than the
right.
bass part or the percussive sound.
If you listen to a song like Don't Stop Believin', it takes a fairly long time to get to the chorus. You know, I don't mind waiting, but I think one of the other big things that the Swedes did was they said, that's too, don't bore us, get to the chorus. And songs that the Swedes make, Taylor Swift songs, Katy Perry songs, you get to it pretty, you know, you're going to hear her roar pretty quickly.
Pretty early on.
And you're going to hear her regularly roaring in the course of that song.
And also that the lyrics don't need to make sense, that they actually need to sound good.
Yeah, this is another thing that I think is an advantage. People do speak English, but they don't speak it to the level where they're going to be playing around with metaphor and, you know, witty little sort of turns of phrase. Yeah, so the Swedes are able to, Max Martin calls it melodic math. It's a way of matching the melodies to the words without getting hung up on the sense of the words.
That melodic math and the focus on the chorus led to a sort of industrialized assembly line method for writing pop songs. Producers create dozens of tracks, basically instrumental versions, and send those tracks out to as many artists as possible. If an artist likes the track, they'll record a song on top of it. It's faster than the classic approach where musicians sit down to write a whole song all at once.
You basically, to be in this business, you kind of have to do both.
Brian Frizzell, also known as Frequency, is a Grammy Award-winning pop and hip-hop producer.
First, there's definitely, I found this great artist. Nobody knows who he is, but I think this music is great. Let's try to make a great song and something great will happen with it. And then the other side is, you know, let's work on a track and let's send this out and try to shop it to somebody.
I call it track and hook. And a track would be the basic chord progression and the sort of instrumentation is somewhat worked up with the synths and everything. But the track and hook method is extremely important because when you use that method to write a song, a producer can write basically 30 or 40 tracks, and then you can begin sending them out to different topliners.
A topliner being someone who writes hooks, catchy tunes, and lyrics. Frequency has sent plenty of tracks around, and those tracks have become songs by Snoop Dogg, Ghostface Killah, Lil' Kim, and others. But his biggest smash so far started as a passion project with a smaller New York singer.
I was working with an artist named BB Rexha, not for any specific purpose, but just to try to make some great songs because she's a great artist and a great writer. And the song basically started with just piano. And like once we kind of had like the melody and a couple like gibberish words, then we like really sat down and figured out like what the lyrics were gonna be.
Yeah, you think I'm crazy. Yeah, you think I'm crazy. Well, that's nothing.
We started with the chorus first, and then once we had the chorus, we went and worked on the verses, almost like kind of collaging the melodies together. Like this part sounds great to start off with.
No.
Then it should go to this part, and then it should go to this part.
Yeah, that's nothing.
The whole thing came together really, really quick, and it was basically in demo form, you know, because we did it in 4 or 5 hours, but the melody was so strong that, like, we knew that it was something, but we weren't thinking about it, that it was going to be for anybody else other than a song for her.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed.
If this sounds familiar, it's because you've probably heard it before. The song is called The Monster, and Frequency eventually sold it to Eminem and Rihanna.
It's pretty crazy because, like, it came so quickly. We finished it, and, like, we were super happy with it, and then, like, it ended up changing the course of everybody's life, but we didn't know it at the time. At the time, we were just like, this is, like, really, really catchy.
Catchy was good, but it wasn't exactly a rap song. About a week after finishing the demo, Frequency was at a Christmas party with some industry players. He played the song for an A&R rep at Eminem's label.
And he was like, you know, this is great, but like, you know, the Shakira stuff is not going to work if it's going to be an Eminem song. So then the next like week, I ended up working on the production and I did about 3 different versions before we got to the final one. And each version I would do and send over to him and he would just be like, nope, it's not right. And I had to get through him first for him to like it. Then he had to go to Eminem's manager for him to like it. And then his manager had to pass it on to Eminem. And then he had to like it. So, you know, it was 3 levels. And I remember when I sent the last one, I said, this is the last one. I'm done. Like, if they don't like it, then it just is not going to work as a hip-hop song. And then a couple of days later, they hit me up and said, Eminem loves it. He wants it. Don't send it to anybody else. And then radio silence. We didn't know what was going on.
Frequency says this happens all the time. Artists record 30 or 40 songs for an album and end up using only 10 or 12. So even if an artist records your song, there's no guarantee that anything will come of it. John Seabrook explains why.
It's all about making a hit. So if you make 50 songs, you might have 5 that sound pretty good, or you might get 2 or 1 that's a hit.
It's really like these intangible factors. You have to have a great song or great songs, that's a given. You have to have a great voice, that's a given. Most of the time, you have to be on a major label or somehow associated with a major label because it takes money to break an artist.
Making a hit requires the whole radio promotion campaign, which is a huge part of why the hits remain in the control of the labels, because only the labels have the resources to mount, you know, large campaigns to top 40 radio stations, asking them all to play the songs at the same time.
If a song's not working at radio, the record labels pull it. They move on to the next single. They move on to the next artist. They're not going to try to beat a song that's not working.
After 10 months of silence, The Monster by Eminem featuring Rihanna suddenly hit the airwaves.
I kind of lost it. I flipped out. I kind of jumped up and ran around and I picked up my little Shih Tzu and I was having him dance with me in my apartment. Yep.
I wanted the fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music. Wanted to be left alone in public, excuse me.
The Monster ended up going triple platinum in the U.S. It hit #1 on the Billboard Hot 100 and won a Grammy.
It was kind of like the culmination of 10 years of work. You know, I talk about like Malcolm Gladwell and 10,000 hours or whatever it is. You're probably talking about 20,000 hours. It takes a long time.
I'm friends with the Monster.
The Monster was Frequency's first number one record and his first Grammy. It's a game changer for his career in the music industry. But according to John Seabrook, Frequency's experience is rare. At the top of the pyramid, he says, you see mostly the same hit makers and the same artists, and the Swedish Song Factory is still on top. Now, you write that these song factories in the past, be it, you know, Phil Spector's or Berry Gordy's, that they really only lasted about 6 years. But it appears that this particular song machine has been going on for quite some time.
Well, the thing about hit-making machines of the past is they tended to have kind of one sound, and that sound either became dated or it became possible to copy that sound quite easily, and then they lost their edge. But I think what Max Martin has been able to do very, very cleverly and very well is he's become a mentor, essentially, and he's been able to kind of change his sound by latching on to younger, sort of edgier sounds that energize that kind of pure pop sort of genius that he has.
I imagine that before you started working on this book, you weren't a big pop music fan. But
I'd been a pop music fan probably back in my teenage days.
So do you like it now? Do you listen to it more now?
I'm aware of it more. But, you know, this is the thing about writing. When I was writing the book, sometimes, Madeline, I would be thinking like, oh, my gosh, I'm like a guy in his 50s, and I'm sitting here spending the whole day writing about Katy Perry. I just actually today was looking at the top 10 hits from 50 years ago and thinking, okay, these songs are pretty much all still in rotation. You know, Help was number one, Unchained Melody, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. These songs are still very much part of everyday listening experience. Will the songs that are on the top 10 right now be that present? I guess I would be very surprised if they are. I think a lot of what makes songs hits today are not so much that incredible melody or the lyric that is very memorable, but it's the sound, you know, it's the production that kind of make you listen to those songs. But I think those qualities won't necessarily lead to longevity, because I think those qualities become dated pretty quickly and, you know, as people move on to new sounds.
John Seabrook, he's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and his new book is called The Song Machine Inside the Hit Factory. John, this has been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Mal. That's really interesting.
And also thanks to Brian Frizzell, also known as Frequency, a Grammy Award-winning pop and hip-hop producer. 'Cause baby, now we got that. House music was the sound of rebellion during the apartheid era in the 1980s. Now it's South Africa's most popular music. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Any guess which country is the world's largest consumer of house music? Well, per capita, it is, drumroll please, South Africa. South Africa, where house music regularly outsells American pop giants like Katy Perry and Taylor Swift. So how did this come to be? Who are the main players in the South African house scene? Here to tell us all about it is KCRW's DJ extraordinaire, Aaron Bird.
Why, thank you, Madeline.
So tell us about house music in South Africa. How did it get there in the first place?
Well, it was first introduced in the late 80s, pretty much by Frankie Knuckles, who's one of the pioneers of house music in Chicago. In fact, he spun at this club called The Warehouse, and his mix of music was eventually codified into being called house music from Warehouse. They just shortened Warehouse because they didn't know what to call it.
Oh, okay.
So in the late 80s, it made its way over to South Africa. And rhythmically, it sort of went hand in hand with a style of dance called patsula. And patsula is Zulu for wadding like a duck. And that is actually a derivative of Sotho dance, a couple of different dances, which, funny enough, was actually heavily influenced by the Charleston and other dances of American jazz in the 20s and 30s.
Oh my gosh, you're blowing my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But getting back to Petsula in particular, it originated in Sophiatown and Alexandria, which are townships right outside of Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s and 60s, it started off as sort of, if you could imagine, breakdancing competition. And it eventually became to represent a political resistance of sorts against the anti-apartheid movement.
So this is the dance you're talking about?
This is the dance, yeah.
And what kind of music were they dancing to when they were doing this?
They would often dance to hand claps. I mean, it's called Patsula, and as I said, Zulu for wadding like a duck. So if you could imagine that sort of low to the floor, uneven sort of rhythmic movements, and your rear end is usually sticking up a bit, that style just seemed to mimic the rhythm and flow of house music.
So what was it about this music that was so rebellious and that linked it to the anti-apartheid movement?
Well, when they first heard house music, they called it hardcore music. So by definition, it represented something that was aggressive, that was against, that was anti, that was resistant.
Hmm.
So put it in the context of the time in the 80s, it was also a time when hip-hop made it to a wider scale around the world as well. And that was also something that represented Black youth culture being rebellious.
Yeah, and I guess anytime you get a bunch of young people together who are dancing to music that is not understandable, it's threatening, right?
I would imagine when you're in a country like that, you are searching for a source of cultural identity and pride. So when you have something that doesn't look like the oppressor, doesn't sound like the oppressor, doesn't feel like the oppressor, you really, really want to hold on to it.
So how did it actually get there? The house music from the 80s, how did it actually physically get to South Africa, which was pretty much cut off from the rest of the world, right, during apartheid?
There's one DJ in South Africa who said he remembers hearing Frankie Knuckles in 1987.
So it was imported from Chicago, but then there were also local homegrown house artists, right?
Yeah, primarily there's a guy that goes by Oskido, who's considered the pioneer of house music in South Africa. And he has quite a large offspring in the form of plenty of contemporary producers nowadays, such as Black Motion, Kaluwa De Song, and certainly the biggest artist and producer in South Africa is Black Coffee. I don't know about you, but I can imagine some ducks wadding to this.
I know, totally. I feel like doing it myself. Waddling. So is there a big club scene in South Africa?
Huge club scene in South Africa. Yeah. I mean, some of these artists, including Black Coffee that we hear in the background, I mean, they sell out stadiums. These are huge. You think about Taylor Swift selling out the Staples Center. Well, Black Coffee can do the same in Johannesburg.
Is the music also now being exported back here to the United States?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Black Coffee will come to L.A. and sell a venue out as well. And yeah, South African house music is all over the place.
Who else do you want to play for us?
I really like this other young cat named Kaluwa De Song. I think behind Black Coffee, at least outside of South Africa, he is considered the next best South African house DJ. And he's a young cat. I think he's now maybe only about 23 or 24. People who are familiar with South African house and deep house, they'll recognize this track.
Oh, this is cool. So here I really feel like this is an African song because you can really hear the drumming that sounds really African to me.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubting where this is from. That's for sure.
Do you have a favorite?
Probably Kalua DeSong, actually.
Yeah.
I like Kalua DeSong, and then there's also Black Motion, which is actually a group comprised of two DJs. But Black Motion and Kalua DeSong, I really, really dig. Yeah.
Okay, let's go out on one more.
So this is the one where Black Coffee and Kalua DeSong remix the track. It sounds really good just over our headphones.
Yeah.
And so if you could imagine being in a club with a proper sound system, man, this will be close to a spiritual experience. I remember the first time I heard Deep House, I instantly had a vision of somewhere in the bush, there being a group, a circle of people, and they having drums next to a fire. And this is the sort of rhythm that they had. Still to this day, when I listen to it, like, that's what I envision. Yeah.
That's so interesting. I don't think I've ever heard that before. I mean, I think, you know, people think of house, they think of, like, I don't know, think of something that's so not of nature. Like, yeah. Maybe the most artificial music.
Well, I would argue they probably don't know that much about house music.
Right.
Then. Yeah. Again, deep house is certainly in its own pocket, but I would say African and Latin percussion-based house is perhaps even more niche in terms of how specific of a sound it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's incredible. I think it's, this song is recent. I think it's no more than 5 or 6 years old, but the rhythm and the essence and spirit in which it originates, I think, is from the dawn of time.
Aaron Bird, KCRW's DJ. You can hear him live Thursdays, midnight to 3 a.m. Well, thanks, Aaron.
Thank you so much. It's been, I might say that I love your show, and this is a great honor and pleasure to be on Press Play. So thank you.
Thank you. That's our show for today. Stay tuned for Warren Olney and To The Point coming up at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.